Hello, everyone. Heartiest greetings from beautiful Cape Town, South Africa. It has been a very long time since we've connected in this way, and it is my joy to do so now. Lots of great questions have come in, which I look forward to addressing. And I think we should just get right down to it. And if anyone has questions about my life here or any specifics about that, rather than me unsolicitedly giving out information in that regard, I'll wait for that interest. But most importantly, I'd want to get straight to your questions. So let's just, before we get to the questions, one thing I'd like to underscore is that as I've noticed a lot of even long-term veteran followers of this work, that term I like to use very loosely, have kind of fallen into different areas of examination of interests with regard to the body. And that's great. That's really, really good, as one should. But there's some stumbling that can go along with that, because there's a lot of sort of partial truths and great marketing schemes and different things out there. So I just want to kind of bring everyone back to the context of this work, because it's very, very specific. And to especially underscore that this knowledge is not about being food-based or diet-based, as most people assume it is. It's really important to grasp. This is not about food. It's not about diet. We use food and diet as a tool, but this work is about remediating the being to a fully life-generating state so that the life force can flow unobstructed, and thereby conduct copious amounts of centripetally spinning energy. That's what it's about. Okay, so any mentions of food and diet are simply to get that copious spinning of centripetal force. So that's what liberates and feeds the spirit. That's what releases enormous amounts of primal energy from the atoms of your cells and your tissues. It's not about food and diet. Those things are just tools for the life-generating energy. Okay, so there's more energy than you realize within you, but it's trapped and it's suppressed under the, rather than, you know, copious amounts of centripetally spinning energy, it's trapped and suppressed under copious waste matter. And it's distorted, of course, by lineage, as we know, these generations of living out of sync with this centripetal flow. So be very, very careful when you look at things they're being marketed and sold to you. Whether, when I say sold, I'll use that term loosely too, whether it's just, you know, somebody who is enthusiastic about something they read about or something, you know, it could be a friend, it could be in any format. The point is that you just need to ask yourself, is this central to my increase of centripetally flowing, spinning primal energy, or is this going to keep that energy suppressed under the waste matter, distorted by lineage and all that stuff? That's really what it comes down to. Everyone else, if they're not thinking along those lines, they might be a little better off than the person next door. They might be a little leaner. They might be a little sprightlier. But that's not what this work is about. It's not about being a little better off. It's about accessing the fullest power you can access. And that's bigger than you can possibly dream of. I know, I feel it viscerally. I mean, it's like every atom is humming in my body at a magnitude, at a frequency, a rate, of spin that is kind of, out of this world. So you can all access that, and it's awesome. Okay, so let's see. So just remember the move from all of this work is to restore the centripetal flow by removing the blockages in the cells and tissues, at which point the lineage can be rectified. And during the whole process, your primal energy, that God force, if you want to call it that, that original energy from source that's locked in the atoms, its atomic energy, can start circulating more and more in your system. And that's when the magic really starts to happen, the magic I'm talking about. But in order to access that, you have to achieve some real progress in the steps that come before it. And that's where the right kind of dietetic comes along. that's where all the nuances around food come along. So the food aspect isn't the point. It's just a means to a greater end. We have to get the food part right in order to effectively cleanse, but the food part is merely a tool. People get stuck at the food part, but that's myopic thinking, and it's a sticky place that will stunt your growth, meaning your theoretical growth, right? Don't let food hook you. Use it, love it, but don't let it hook you. Don't let this thinking around food, the nutritional information, all that stuff, don't let it hook you. Don't let it get you off track of what really matters, which is the primal force. Don't let other people's thinking hook you. You know, you can be all about primal force, and then they'll say, "Oh, did you hear about this study? Why don't you eat chicken and you eat fish they'll hook you. Don't let them hook you. Okay, you got to keep moving forward. Let them do their things their way. Let them think as they wish. Let them process in their own time. You keep moving forward with what you know, because it's so specific, because it's so precise, because it's so specialized. Sometimes it can feel kind of lonely. And you feel like maybe you're in a world all of your own. It's not necessarily a bad thing. That can happen. But don't look at anyone else and don't feel you have anything to prove or apologize for. That's really important too. Just plug away. So long as you're doing it right, which of course it's my service and my joy to help you ensure that you are. And so long as you don't have blind spots that will ensnare you, so you miss the centripetal spin entirely on the way there because you insist upon clinging to some misguided ideology or a personal addiction, that happens a lot, or some sort of a fear in your mind that's blocking you, you will get there. And you can't benefit from this wellspring of knowledge if you're handcuffed by something else or you're being hooked into other people's way of thinking or into your own patterns of thinking. Okay. So given that context, please don't forget it. Or while you might get some benefit, you won't get this mountaintop experience I'm talking about. Okay. So today we're going to address big picture things and we're going to address the food minutiae points. But in all of that, please, please, please don't lose the context I've just established. Okay. Great. So let's get started. Let me get these questions out then in front of me. All right. So I'm going to read the questions through because I want to bring about the nuance of what they're trying to communicate and their members who want their questions answered. So I want to make sure that I'm answering exactly what they're asking, even though I'm known to go off track a little bit. So someone writes in, "I've experienced many exciting symptoms during my ascension to my higher self, and I'm curious about the, quote, Buddha belly symptom that some are experiencing along with weight gain. This is stated to be a temporary condition as your body reconfigures itself to accommodate the new higher frequency coming in for our ascension into more awakened extrasensory beings. It is also explained as what occurs when the lung and diaphragm grow so we can experience conscious breath." Okay, so I am not going to lay claim to any kind of enlightenment. You're going to hear lots of sounds because my 4-year-old's having a bunch of friends over. Okay, so people can talk about enlightenment. I think it's a dangerous term to throw around unless you're talking about specifically what enlightenment means, physically, biochemically, physically meaning biochemically, spiritually, emotionally, mentally, sexually. That literally means that all of those aspects of your being go back to having centripetal spin, that you're basically in the light, which is the primal energy, the primal force. So the only way to get there is the removal of blockages. So to me, this Buddha belly thing, for a couple of points, the things that come up. One is that it sounds like gas pressure to me. And a lot of times people are, when they're making progress with the cleansing, their body's so keen to start releasing from deep in the tissue that in effect, they wind up pulling up a lot of the gas pressure, which needs to leave, which is great, which is good, but it can expand the body. So in a sense, it's true. As the body enlightens, it's going to have to release some of this gas pressure because there's so much gas pressure locked in the cells and tissues. And in doing that, there can be an expansion. So it's not wrong per se, but I wouldn't equate it with a kind of enlightenment in terms of a higher self. That can get very dangerous. So that's where I would be very careful. Okay. This work could arguably be called a work of enlightenment if you want to consider it to, in its literal context. Enlightenment is a constant evolution toward the embodiment of more primal energy and less of a kind of material chaos. But the cells and tissues are packed with primal energy. So don't look at the body as being a kind of dense chaos. It's that which has been lodged in the body that wasn't assimilated and eliminated that becomes a dense chaos. You see what I mean? So that's why it's all the dense chaos. Those blockages get broken down. That's why we have the decay cycle. So, and which releases it, so that releases the energy that's you know, that can't be created or destroyed. It just is, releases that energy so that it can be then recycled and given another shot. But be very careful at looking at the body itself, the bones, tissues, as unenlightened, because remember, they're made up of electrons, they're made up of atoms. And those atoms, within those atoms, you have the primal force all locked in. Just because normal people walking around haven't found a way to unlock the primal force from those atoms doesn't mean that it can't be done and it's not there. So be careful with these concepts. Use them if you're using them with a lot of attention to their literal meaning and to their assumed meaning, because they can really confuse you up a lot in the wrong context. So as your body lightens, right, your heart lightens, you release attachments to ideologies and belief systems which make you less addicted to substances and less attached to crutches. So you have this marvelous self-feeding enlightenment cycle where you release more physically, mentally, spiritually, and your energetic blueprint becomes more and more primal force intense. But it's got nothing to do with a Buddha belly. You know, as far as I'm concerned, if you're asking me, I think it's kind of an excuse for having, be a sort of an excuse for your belly. But if the belly's expanding and you're doing everything right, it's simply because you're trying to release stuff and your body's not necessarily keeping up with it, or you're mixing things in that shouldn't be mixed in, you know, or there's too much consumption, you know, which can happen too. And sometimes we just make friends with those things and we say, okay, you know what, you know, I'm doing a lot, but I can't take away this crutch and this addiction all the time. It's just too much for me. So you just stay where you are. It's okay. Like, but rather be okay with it and accept that it's just part of your body's morphing while you're cleansing and while you're establishing your healthy, comfortable boundaries around the process, rather than saying it's something to do with something spiritual or a Buddha belly, as it were. That's my two cents on that matter. And I actually will add one more thing. Remember that things were written about in the past should be taken very lightly. So they come from traditions that used lots of allegory, and they also change as the blueprint of life and our ability to tune into higher cosmic intelligence expands. So, you know, if you're taking a concept like the Buddha belly concept from something that was written a long time ago, that may have been applicable then, but not now. See? So remember that it's the book of life. The book of life cannot be held. It can't be, if something is written down, it can calcify. The concept can calcify unless it's true in the moment. Unless it's again part of the book of life. What's happening in a present state of life's expression, and you can prove it by looking at it and seeing the cause and effect around it, then be careful. If you can't figure out how something, you know, so let me see if I can rephrase this. If you get stuck, it's easy to get stuck in a concept if your mind is not fluid enough to flow around it. So if I say to you that, be careful about things that were written before, you might think, oh my gosh, but then what am I going to look toward? That's where you really have to start to read the book of life and see how things work. In your own body is the perfect book of life, because you're watching all of this and you're seeing how these natural laws that I've been teaching about in the mastery classes, especially, how they all play out, especially in the body. You can see it. But you have to make your mind very fluid in order to do that. So you have to be able to be fluid enough so that if your mind gets stuck on something and you're not sure what to do with it, you either have to find a way to flow around it. So your mind has to be able to flow around this idea and get past it. Or you have to be able to go from your perspective to rise up to the eagle. So say, you know, you see that you can't figure out where you're going, so you got to go up. You got to go up so you can get a bigger perspective and then look out. If you get stuck, being stuck is not where you want to be. If you're feeling stuck, you either have to flow around it or you have to rise above it. And if you can't figure out how something applies, like in this situation, you're thinking, well, what's going on? Is this a Buddha belly? What's happening? And enlightenment and ascension and higher self, and just try and go above the concept. There's always a higher perspective. I promise you that. And with a lot of these terms, you have to go to the higher perspective because there's so much new agey, mumbo jumbo-y stuff out there that has been turned into a kind of dense chaos, just like anything else that's gotten stagnant and hasn't been the beneficiary of a very alive kind of attention to the concept. Hope that makes sense. Okay, so, and just remember, your body is constantly reconfiguring itself based on every single influencing factor on your blueprint every second. That means everything you're exposed to, everything you think about, everything you feel is reconfiguring your body, reconfiguring your energy body. It's all happening in real time. So the best way you can direct your reconfiguration is to set your mind to the highest potential in yourself that you believe you can truly anchor in yourself each day. And then you fulfill that vision with the lifestyle choices, with the thoughts, with the emotional feelings that support it. So just remember, you're in a constant state of reconfiguration, and you can decide, you can direct your own personal reconfiguration constantly, which if you want it to be higher self, ascension, enlightenment, then you have to be ready, A, to apply the lifestyle aspects that are going to support it, and B, you have to be ready to eliminate those blockages. So this is where the frequent colonics and frequent sitting alone and reflecting and doing the recapitulation exercises. A lot of people want to get to ascend, meaning to get to a higher state of being. Let's not mix up that concept. I'm not talking about suddenly floating up to the clouds. So a lot of people want to be enlightened. A lot of people want to connect with their higher self, but the higher self is that which is not obstructed by the dense chaos. It's pure primal consciousness. And you have pure primal consciousness in your body. It's not outside of your body. I want to articulate that very, very carefully, just to make sure nobody thinks they need to leave their body to ascend. The transmutation, the transfiguration that happens within the cells and tissues that I think my body's in the process of going through. I don't know if it's always something that happens, in a snap, in the blink of an eye, but it certainly isn't happening that way for me. It's happening kind of bit by bit. But as my ego goes higher, my ability to anchor what I see in my body becomes more possible and how can I put this? I see what needs to be done, and then it's my choice. Am I able to do it? Do I think I can do it? If I do think I can do it, then I do it. If I think I need a little more time to get my head around something, then I give myself a little more time to get my head around it. But the body, it happens right here in the body, not outside the body. Okay, so Buddha belly, that's going to be up to you, given all that. Let's see. Is there anything else to say on that? Look, I think that something to address here is just also our potential. And I know my potential for life force. Everyone needs to kind of tap into what has your highest experience been in your body. And for some of you, that will mean thinking back to when you were 5, 6, 7, 8 years old, before your body got clogged. And you know, hopefully you had some years where you felt that lightness of being. And one of the things that blew me away when I started to feel that visceral hum in my body, which is hard to explain until you actually have had it. And the people who have had it, usually you'll start to feel it when you wake up in the morning, because your body, as you cleanse, you'll start to feel it more and more when you wake up in the body, because you wake up in the morning, because your body's had this so much processing time. So you'll start to tap into it. But when I first felt it, I was like, oh my gosh, I remember this. I used to feel like this when I was a kid. And I don't mean that happy-go-lucky feeling. I mean, like, I suppose the best way to describe it is like when you look at a hummingbird and that pulse, that hum, that zzzz, and then literally the zzzz is running through your body. And I've asked my husband sometimes in the morning, like, do you feel that? Like, is the bed actually moving? Is it just me? Because my body will be just going zzzz. And, you know, so if I don't feel that, and I know that's my potential, now, you know, you have to figure out what is your potential? What's the highest you've experienced? But if you can remember what it felt like before your body got clogged and it started to sort of be more dense chaos than primal energy, you'll be able to have something to shoot for. But most people don't remember what that feels like at all. But the point is, know your potential. So when I'm in my potential, my body is in bliss. It makes me vibrate, like I said, on the bed when I wake up, and I can feel it's like my cup runneth over in my heart with love juice. It's like, and so I feel this center petal spin, and I see no evidence of aging, right? Instead, I see the opposite. And I rarely find myself outside of this state of being these days, even though I live a very intensely busy life. I'm not sitting around, you know, meditating all day. I like to think that life, you know, becomes that state of being. And it has for me. I've been very, very fortunate to have been able to focus my attention. And I've had so much passion around driving my attention to this area that I've, you know, sort of reaped the reward of it. But even though I live an intensely busy life and I have an equally energetic social life, I have this buzz because I'm doing the things I know I need to do to maintain this buzz, which has a lot to do with my constant state of reconfiguration. I'm keeping my self, my mind, my heart, my spirit, my everything I think is in alignment with the primal energy. So I feel the buzz. But the moment I don't feel the buzz, I know I need to take the time and whatever attention or application I need to get my buzz back. And for me, having that strong centripetal spin viscerally running through me is my top priority. It comes before everything else because it's going to determine the well-being of my family, of everything around me. So it's not just, it's, you know, it sounds really selfish. Well, that's your top priority is your centripetally spinning, you know, atoms. Really? You know, what about your kids? What about their homework assignments? What about, well, that will get done, and that will get done better if I'm in my centripetal spin. Okay, so let's move on to the next question. Okay, let's see here. I have to keep on going back and forth from the recorder to the questions. Okay, next question is, my understanding has always been that although lemons and other citrus are classified as, quote, acid fruit, they actually leave an alkaline ash in the body and are therefore a good food to include in a diet to help alkalize an acid system. However, a while ago I visited a well-respected natural therapist who uses dowsing, among other things, to find allergies, intolerances, etc. She says she's finding citrus is a problem for almost everyone she meets as it's picked unripe to be transported to us here in the UK, and never properly ripens, causing it to have an acidic effect on the body rather than the alkaline effect it would normally have if eaten ripe. She said that they are fine if eaten ripe in their native climates. Natalia's approach obviously uses lemons quite extensively, assuming you're including them in daily juices and salad dressings. That's what Detox the World, well, what's Detox the World take on this? I found I can have the juices without lemons, so that's not an issue for me, but it's difficult to find any good salad dressings which don't include lemons or even more acidic alternatives such as vinegar, and I'm concerned in particular about the effect on my teeth. Such a great question. So isn't it interesting that this woman with her dowsing is confirming in her practice what we've been talking about for so long, which is, yes, fruits, vegetables, these things, they need to actually grow to fruition, literally to fruition, right, before they're picked. And if there is any interference in their development, there is going to be a price to be paid, which is a price to be paid in acidity. So that's true. However, here's, you know, okay, so what I would do is I would just try to get the best lemons you can and do your best. I do so many lemons every day, it's true. And, you know, I'm getting a lot of my lemons, they're organic from the supermarket. I've got lovely lemon trees, and I wind up half the time just with all I have a house full of people. Not only do I have three children, but we have just constant stream of people. So we have to, and no one else eats like I do, right? My daughter a bit, like, it's a long story. A lot goes on in this house. So there's a big mix. And I just grab a lemon knowing that it's the best lemon we can have. I don't make a fuss about it. But I also live otherwise highly, highly alkalinized lifestyle. So it's true that they should be picked ripe. It's true that, you know, they should be grown organically, and all these things are true. But here's the other thing. Lemons cut through mucus, especially the rind of the lemons, like nobody's business. So there's so many benefits to even a lemon that's not going to necessarily leave an alkaline ash. It's not going to be acidic in the system. Your lemons, your organic lemons, even if they're pricked prematurely, are not going to leave an acid ash when all is said and done, right? So after the body has digested it, and it's got, but the ash is basically the way the residue in the bloodstream. What is it? How does it affect the, well, residue is maybe the wrong word. How does it affect the blood chemistry? So does it cause the blood chemistry to become to err on being more acidic, or to err on being more alkaline? And naturally, the blood itself can't be swinging back and forth. The blood has to stay in a state of homeostasis. But if there's too much acid in the body, then the blood, in order to maintain that state of homeostasis at 7.4 on the litmus paper, it's going to need to draw from alkaline resources in the body. It's going to need to take out deposits from the alkaline bank account, as it were. So is the food you eat, you can ask yourself this question, is it going to require you to have to take a withdrawal on your alkaline, your alkaline account? Or is it going to be a deposit? That's the wrong word. Is it going to cause you to have to take out money from your alkaline account? Or is it going to enable you to make a deposit in your alkaline account? Okay, that's the way to look at it. So even if they're not picked ideally, they will cut through mucus. They will still only, at worst, leave an inconsequential ash, meaning a neutral ash. And I would not use any other acid. So definitely don't use, I'm not a fan of apple cider vinegar. I believe it actually leaves an acidic ash in the body. I've always felt it too in my human laboratory. And of course, all the other vinegars are just terrible, terrible. So, you know, the apple cider vinegar might be only mildly acidic in its end result, but all the other vinegars are really, really acidic. So lemons and limes, do the best you can. I have zero teeth problems. But let me tell you how I care for my teeth. I'm like fastidious with my teeth. Simply, I brush, but yeah, it's very simple. It's a simple regime, but it's fastidious. So I brush several times a day, probably, I'd say about four times a day. I always brush after exercise. So I'll brush when I wake up. I'll brush if I sweat or exercise. I'll always brush right after that. I'll usually brush again sometime, you know, randomly in the afternoon. Like, you know, it's just kind of, it's important to constantly keep, it's this orifice that's just dumping waste all day long, just like, you know, your lower orifices, and it has to be eliminated. So you got to keep, so I used a tongue scraper, and And I use really high quality natural toothpaste. Nothing fancy, like nothing specific. It doesn't have to be this particular brand I use. I actually rotate the toothpaste, but you know, it's natural, pure toothpaste. And it's less about the toothpaste, as long as it's natural toothpaste and it's not got, you know, any fluoride or chemicals in it. As long as it's a good natural toothpaste, it's more about the actual brushing and cleaning away of this waste that's coming through the tissues of the tongue and through the little, these minuscule little holes in the teeth and the gums. They're just pushing matter through the body all day long from the gut. So it's really, really important to keep your mouth really clean. So if you're worried about lemon, if you're genuinely worried about lemon in your teeth, a couple things. Always use a straw when you're drinking something with lemon in it. And you can always just hold some bentonite solution in your mouth after a lemony intake. So, you know, these things are so simple. You actually don't have to go and buy a special mouthwash or anything. Just take some bentonite clay, mix it with some water, and swish it around in your mouth right after you've had your lemony meal, if it really concerns you. If you're doing a lot of other acidic things and you're having mainstream lemons, then you might have a problem. But if your lifestyle and your intake is green-centric and you're cleaning your mouth properly frequently and your elimination process is strong, you're exercising, you're sweating, you're pooing, you're just like, everything is, it's moving through your body as it should be, your lymph is functioning well, then you're not going to have any problems. So yeah, that's pretty much it on the lemon front. Hope that was helpful. Okay, let's see. Next. I have been rereading some of Natalia's old posts for detox inspiration. There's one post in particular I love. It's called Don't Be an Airhead, which discusses the effect of gas accumulation in the bones and particularly the skull. As a history graduate, this particularly resonates with me because what Natalia discusses is so clearly illustrated in the old photographs, and you really only have to go back about 60 or 70 years to see it. If you look at photos of large groups of young men in the mid-20th century, for example, British men being sent off to fight in France in 1939, you are immediately struck by how slim their faces are, how refined and clear their features, and what a thick and healthy head of hair they have, with very few showing signs of thinning or receding hairlines. Obviously there's some exceptions, as the diet was already corrupted, but compare that to a similar group of men at a football match today, and it's evident that contemporary men have much thicker faces and thinner hair. Very good observation. Often receding from the front. In the UK, you see it more in, quote, blue-collar men than in men from wealthier backgrounds, but it's becoming more and more common throughout. I'm even noticing it more and more in young children, which is really sad. On a similar note, there was a recent photo in a UK newspaper of the first England rugby team back in the late 19th century. And if you compare that with a photo of the current England or any other national rugby team, you wouldn't believe they're playing the same game. The physique of the original rugby players was more like the tennis or soccer players of today. That's fascinating. I also saw this personally about 10 years ago whilst working on a volunteer program in Peru. In Cusco, a very westernized city where we were based, the native peoples were very heavy, in particular with thick thighs and faces and skin problems, the effects of their westernized diet. However, when we visited a much more isolated area called Rumbama, where fewer Westerners go, we were struck by the healthy and beautiful look of all the people, all slim with beautiful skin and hair. And on holiday in Morocco a few years ago, my husband and I were in awe of the perfect skin and teeth of the Berber people we met. Okay, then she writes, apologies for digressing so much and for such a long email, but this is the kind of information from Natalia that makes detoxing so interesting and exciting. Oh, good, thank you. I'm so glad to hear that. And these were great examples. Thank you, thank you, thank you for sharing that. Okay, but now getting to her question. My question is regarding Natalia's comment in that post about sugars and starches. She says that people living on their native and natural diets do not show these signs of this accumulation of gas, which is obviously true. However, she says that this is due in part to the very small quantities of animal products in their diet, which I believe is true relative to today, and also lack of sugars and starches in their diet. But my understanding is that organic, whole, and unadulterated whole grains and starches, i.e. whole rye and wheat grain breads in Europe, unleavened breads in Hunza, and much of the Middle East, starchy vegetables in large parts of Africa, have played an important role, in the diet of these people for thousands of years without negative effect, and that it's only when these foods are interfered with, refined, and used to excess that the real breakdown in health begins. I'd be really grateful if you could clarify this for me. I understand that neither animal products or grains are considered to be optimal food for man, but I understood that people have thrived on grains and starchy vegetables so long as they consume them in their natural states as supplements to a diet high in raw and cooked fruits and vegetables. And she writes, sorry, I have a PS. I understand that this accumulation of gas in the bones of contemporary peoples coincides not just with the changes in diet, but also with the widespread move from breastfeeding to formula feeding. And she writes, her sons are 7 and 5, and sadly, when we used to visit the baby groups, I could usually guess which babies were being bottle fed because their faces were much bigger. My friend called this look formula face. I've also noticed that my sons have perfect dental arches in contrast to the appalling crowded dental arches of me and my husband, who were both formula fed in the 70s. Wow. Okay. That's a very, very interesting question. So much there. Thank you for sending this in. It's very well written, by the way. I enjoyed reading it just now. Okay. So let's see. Let's take this apart a little bit. The starches. Okay. So sugars, we know. The sugars and the animal products we know, but let's focus on the starches for a second. The way I would like you or anyone who's interested in this question to think about it is not that the starches were great. Like, you may have read about the Hunza people, as she writes about in here, but like it was very popular a few years ago. It was a big feature on the Hunza people and this kind of manna-like bread they would eat. And everyone say, well, it's because of this dense grain that they lived so long and that they were so healthy. No. In fact, it's because they lived in these in this mountainous region with so much alkalinity and that they were so underexposed to the Western world that they lived so well and so long. The fact that they happen to have a relatively high-integrity grain product as a part of their diet is not the reason they lived so long. It's probably the reason they didn't live as long as they could have lived. So it's a very different way of looking at it. Very similar to this is the fermented food conversation. So the idea that the fermented foods are so great because these people who lived in the Caucasus Mountains lived so long on them, or lived so long was attributed to the fermented foods, and so fermented foods gained so much credibility, which I question because I don't encourage fermented foods. I haven't for a very long time. There was a small moment when I thought, well, maybe there's something to it. But the more I explored it and the more I put it into my personal laboratory, I found that it actually was not a great move. So same thing. So they were using the fermented foods. That's not what gave them the longevity. You know, a lot of people have different opinions. To the opinion I have, or the belief I have in terms of how long we should be able to live, and that has a lot to do with what I know about the human potential, because I'm experiencing something quite different in my life experience than most people do. So I believe we were meant to live many hundreds of years, potentially beyond that. I don't like to put limitations on things because I just don't know that answer. I don't know how far it can go, but from what I know about primal force and primal energy, whatever you want to call it, the life force, the primal fire, I know it's unquenchable under certain circumstances, but we don't necessarily give ourselves those circumstances, those conditions for the unquenchable fire. I'm personally working on it. I don't know many people who are. And so is it that they live so long because they live to be 125, say, or is it that they actually, undercut their true longevity by a lot because they were consuming things that weren't as digestible? So I don't know. I mean, I think it's a really interesting question, but one thing I will say for sure is that I don't believe that starches made these cultures stronger than they would have been without the starches. If we're talking about, remember, it's also important to say there's the real difference between the biochemical components, the biomass of a grain versus a root vegetable. So something like a baked sweet potato is always going to be much cleaner, much more digestible, leave far less residue, be more neutral on in terms of its acidic alkaline ash than a grain will be. And of course, the degree to which the grain has been refined will determine the degree to which it leaves an acidic ash as well. But root vegetable starch over grain any day of the week. So there's a difference there as well. Okay, hopefully that was helpful. Let's see, I think I hit every point there. Very, very interesting, enlightening all the way around as she shared her travels and the breastfeeding information and all of that. Okay, next question. Well, interesting. So the next question is, I wanted to ask about fermented foods and Natalia's thoughts on them now. I know at one point she was still carrying out research on whether they were helpful or not. I know myself, I have experimented with them on and off over the years and am uncertain whether they are helping or hindering. There is so much talk on them now and their benefits, but I personally am uncertain. Well, how funny that we just said that. Okay, so yes, I think their benefits are dubious at best, and I don't include them, and I'm the first person to do that which is most beneficial to the tapping into the primal force of every atom in my being. So, yeah, I can say I don't think that that is conducive to greater primal force. Okay, when I say that, I mean fermented foods. And remember, if you're going to do fermented foods, be sure to have them within the first 6 days of them being prepared, because otherwise they become excessively acidic and just full of lactic acid. Okay, so next question is, my son was recently diagnosed with irritable brain activity after his first seizure. The neurologist expects more seizures. Have you read anything connecting food to seizures, neurological activity? Well, sure. Have I read? Look, I'm not big on reading studies. You guys know that about me. But clearly the chemicals in food, everything's running through the brain. So, and we know that that waste matter gets stored in the brain, meaning waste matter like proteins from flesh foods wind up in the brain. You know, how did they get there? They got there because tissue is permeable. It's not just going to land in the gut. It's going to permeate the entire system. So the same can be said about, you know, whether it's microwave popcorn or chemicals in soil or, you know, GMO seeds that are moving from farm to farm and getting into the organic soils and all of that. The other thing I would think about is, or consider, reflect on, is the HAARP frequency waves, right? The HAARP, which of course sounds kind of like conspiracy theorist, but I'll leave that up to you. Same thing with the chemtrails. So there's a lot going around that's getting into the brains of these little ones, not just the food. So, you know, yes, food is going to play a role because everything, right, everything is influencing our reconfiguration constantly. And so that will be a factor. But there are so many factors. Of course, there's the stress factor, and there's the pressure on little kids today. And there's, oh, geez, I mean, let's talk about the handheld devices for a second, why don't we? And the radiation we're swimming in. So depending on where you live, I think this person actually lives in LA, you know, those are all major factors. Put them all together, and you have, remember, children, until they go through puberty, they're hyper exposed. They're receptive. They're really living the female principle of receptivity, because the reason we were created that way, to be so receptive as young in our early youth, is because we're meant to be receiving as much information as we can for the best for the most information to enter into our DNA and to enter into our minds, our brain, the computer of our brain. All this stuff is supposed to be happening in concentrated amounts very early on in life, so that we can kind of be have so much information, so much knowledge, so much helpful guidance, instinct, all of that kicking in early, early, early. But if we're super receptive and what we're getting instead is this dissonance, then a seizure is like, if you think about it, it is just an expression of dissonance. And that's not to say that the child is dissonant. It's to say that the waves that make up the child are not able to process the dissonance that they're being exposed to. So there's not enough recovery time or enough time away from it. It's one thing to be exposed to something and then have time to recover from it. But if you're just exposed to it nonstop, then at some point the body's just going to have to spasm, which is what's happening. And we spasm in different ways. I mean, seizure is one way that someone, you know, can have that expression. And often that runs in the family, and it's kind of often we will have our weak spot. Like some people have weak teeth, or some people have, you know, the second they get worn down, they don't have time to process, they'll get flu-like symptoms. Some people will have sore joints, and some people will have seizures. And so this is sort of the point that he's expressing, this dissonance, this saying, like, I'm exposed to this, and I'm not able to recover from it. And, you know, that's what I would look to and reflect on if it were my child. Okay, so let's see. Next, and she also wanted to ask for the best advice for preteens and teens starting to see acne. And that's always just to educate them about the fact that which is entering into their system is going to permeate through their skin. The skin is the largest organ, and it's the second largest eliminative organ after the colon. And if their colon is taking in things that it can't process properly, it's going to pass it on to the skin. That's number one. Number two is that as the body retains waste matter, it's going to proliferate pathogens. And so acne is it's fungus. It's a pathogenic expression, and it's waste trying to leave the body. And as it's trying to leave the body, it's decaying, and in the decay process, you have that. What decay is the expression of fungus, mold, bacteria. That's what this is coming through the skin, and that will usually put them off quite a lot. The important thing is to work all angles. So keeping the skin really clean, making sure that the pH of the skin is correct topically, and that the stuff that's causing it stops going in. And a lot of times they won't do that, and they'll live with it, or they'll say, you know what, then put me on something. That would be the worst choice, in my opinion. I've had many discussions about with other moms about this, and some of them just say, well, you know what, it's my child's. It's what is it they say? It's like it's their sense of self-confidence. And they want them to feel good about themselves, and for that they need, they need their clear skin. So let me put them, So I say, whatever happens, put them on. If they're having acne, let me not say whatever happens. If they're having issues with acne, put them on something, and that to me, that's just That's the lesser choice, let's call it that. I personally would cringe at the idea of putting my child on anything like that. I wouldn't do it personally. If they were adamant that they needed to do it, that they wanted to, I've got teenage children, and my daughter's going to be 16 in a couple of months. So, if she were, at the stage she is, if she were to be adamant that she wanted to go on something, it'd be hard for me to stop her. I could educate her, but I would have to give her the freedom to make that choice. But I think it's a very, very damaging choice, because it's not only keeping that waste matter locked up in the tissues in the body, but it's, of course, contributing a huge amount of contamination through the medication itself. So, I think it's very, very damaging, and would not take anything for it if I could help it. I'd like to give people lots of freedom to make choices for themselves. around that, but that's why I've kind of phrased it the way I do. It needs to be seriously looked at, though, and it's those medications are very, very dangerous. They have an impact on the body, particularly the ovaries and the brain and the glands that are, you know, way more catastrophic than people realize, and it's just not worth it for clear skin that can be cleared up in other ways. I am a big believer in teenage facials. I think it's really important for teenagers who are struggling with acne to have regular facials as they clean up their insides to make sure that this bacteria is being cleared off the face, that the pH of the face is being kept in good harmony, that's not getting too dry. Sometimes, you know, a light little, you know, fruit enzyme peel can be really helpful. Anything that will kill the bacteria and help keep the skin clean and with a balanced pH while the diet is being adjusted. It's good. Also, the stress, you know, the kids have so much stress. We have to keep on going back to the stress and pressure that they feel. So all those factors. But I would help them understand specifically what's occurring and that it's bacteria and fungus that's coming through their body onto their skin. That will usually help. Okay. Next question. I was wondering what your thoughts are on aching joints. I've had worsening joints for the last year, and there's quite a lot of conflicting information about it. I'm consuming sugar after having taken it out for many years. My moods, energy, digestion, and weight are all fantastic with fruit, honey, and starchy veggies as part of my diet. But since not much else has seemed to help my joints, I'm thinking about cutting back again to see if it makes a difference. My worry, though, is that my moods and energy won't be as good without the natural sugars. Well, you know, that's something that, you'll only know by experiencing it. I know that I personally don't do well with any sugars in the diet, but I do hold out for my little bit of dark chocolate, though. Not really such a little bit, but I keep everything else almost without any, smidgen of anything sugary, green all the way, and then I have my dark chocolate. So I like to save it for that. But if you're doing well with fruit and honey, then that's great if you can get away with it. You know, if you get away with something, get away with it. Go for it. But if you're finding that your joints are funky, that's something to look at, and you won't know until you try. So see, I would just say see, and always use yourself as your human experiment, your human laboratory, and take a look and see what happens. All right, now let's see. Yeah, I wish I could say more on that, but you'll really only know if you experience it.